Sports Out of Time, Season 2, Opening Pitch. Randall, how did you spend your summer vacation now that it's October?
Wow, let me remember. No, I had a great summer vacation. You know, obviously got to spend some time with you in person, up both in the Adirondacks and here in the Chicagoland area, which was fun both times. Yeah, other than that, I kind of revamped my home office here, so made it a little bit more manageable, and yeah, it's perfect for recording now.
I'm very jealous. It looks great. I know I've talked about that before to you in person, but I want to put it out here on the pod. I'm very jealous. It does mean I'm going to have to go revamp my library room into something more presentable. So yeah, great. My summer was classic teacher stuff. Again, we'll talk a bit about that in just a second. My time's back and forth between here and old Joliet. And we'll talk a little bit more. But right now, folks, we're back. It's Sports Out of Time, Season 2, Episode 1. And today, we're talking about Roberto Clemente. Yeah, I had a great time, actually. We, you know, we'll just do it real quick. You know, we were out in, we were out up north early on this summer. We went out to, I don't even know what the name of that town was, to be honest.
It was North Creek.
North Creek. Mm-hmm. I just remember, I remember the Ordway Pond is what I remember. Right. Less than, that was the little pond we had where we made friends with those turtles.
Yeah.
You got really close with those turtles down there. That was really nice to see.
We did get close to the turtles, but they were very nice turtles.
But I did have a nice time, as always, coming to visit you and your wife slash my sister out in Joliet. We got to play a little golf together. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. We hit up the Topgolf with the kids, right?
That was my first Topgolf experience. I got to be honest. I'd never been to any sort of like Topgolf or even like those sort of like, I know places all over have like the indoor golf where it's like you hit into a screen.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I do.
But that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. And classic fashion, whenever we do something with the kids, I always think to myself, I wonder how much more fun this would have been with just the adults. like how would this experience have been different and how would we have changed how we responded to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, but it was a good time. The kids were, you know, when you do an activity like that, and the kids aren't super young anymore, you know, it's not too bad. So.
That's true. You guys are almost at empty nest situation coming up sooner than later, huh?
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, we've got one in college and one in high school. So yeah, it's you know, time keeps on chugging, man. You can't stop it.
That's right. Speaking of which, time is chugging on. So why don't we get into our discussions for today? Episode one here. We're talking about Roberto Clemente. As like anything else, Roberto Clemente, one of those stories, I think, you know, this touched a lot of things for us. We both love baseball. This is a classic baseball star. And I wouldn't go, you know, people ask me about the show all the time. They say, what's the show about? And I sometimes say, well, it's about like telling undertold stories in baseball or in sports and in different avenues of sports. And I don't want to sit here and say that Roberto Clemente's story is undertold. There's lots of good content out there about Roberto Clemente. But am I wrong in feeling like Roberto isn't thought of in the upper echelon of the great baseball players in the way that maybe he should be?
Yeah, I do think that. I know that people know who Roberto Clemente is, right?
It's
not like, oh, I've never heard of this guy. That's certainly not the case.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But I guess to me, because, you know, it's not like he was Babe Ruth way back when. Mm-hmm. Right. Or Lou Gehrig, you know, or even Mickey Mantle and Joe DiMaggio, you know, predate Roberto Clemente. Yeah. Roberto Clemente's career ended in 1972.
Yeah.
So, you know, that to me, I just felt like I should know more about him because, you know, I was born in 1972. So, you know, while I never obviously didn't get to see him play, you know, he was still part of baseball.
Yeah.
You know,
the greater baseball ecosystem in the era still revolved around Clemente. Yeah.
Yeah. Throughout the 70s. So yeah, I do think you're right that, not under, you know, he's not underreported or under, you know, appreciated necessarily, but just, there's just something missing from popular culture with regards to Roberto Clemente. And I think that's because there's never been that definitive, I think, movie about him.
Yeah, that definitive closure, that definitive representation, whether a documentary or something like it. But it feels like there's a mystery still with Clemente. Yeah. Of course, you know, it's not a spoiler. Clemente, of course, dies in a plane crash on December 31st, 1972. We're not spoiling the story. I'm sure people know that already. But that, again, plays part of the legacy, I think, right? That plays into why the story feels incomplete. And I do think that's worth getting into. Before we do, I think we should set the stage. Randall, you said you were born in 1972. So in December 31st of 1972, I guess you would have been, what, like a month, 2 months?
Well, no, I would have been like, a couple of months. Let's see, 3 months, almost
3 months old. Almost 4 months old on December 31st, 1972, which is where we're going to put today's pop culture time machine. If you were going out to see the number one movie in America on December 31st, 1972, you would be watching The Getaway.
In a hurry, Benyon. You still don't get the picture, do you? And I've always heard what a smart-ass operator you was.
That's a walk-in bank, man. A piece of cake. You don't have to be Dillinger for that one.
So The Getaway is based on a 1958 novel by Jim Thompson. It is a film directed by Sam Peckinpah, and it stars Steve McQueen, Ally McGraw, and Sally Struthers. The plot follows an imprisoned mastermind robber named Carter Doc McCoy, whose wife Carol conspires for his release on the condition that they rob a bank in Texas. Double Cross follows the crime, and the McCoys are forced to flee for Mexico with the police and criminals in hot pursuit. I've never seen this movie. Randy, you ever see this movie?
No, I have not seen this movie.
And, I have heard of it.
You have?
I've heard of it. Just I like movie nerd nonsense, and I was reading about Steve McQueen once, and I feel like I'm aware of the Steve McQueen connection, but I've never seen this.
This would go along with, I think, all Steve McQueen movies. I haven't seen enough of them. Right?
That's right. Yeah. Just The Greatest Escape.
He was a big star at this time, right? Mm-hmm. Steve McQueen was a big star in the 70s. And I haven't seen a lot of his films, and I probably should.
Originally, he seemed like he might not be the easiest guy to work with. Peter Bogdanovich, who had written The Last Picture Show, was the writer here. He had impressed McQueen and producer David Foster. He was originally hired to be the director for The Getaway before Peckinpah. But then the author, Jim Thompson, he had some creative differences between McQueen and Bogdanovich. He's getting some issues, and Bogdanovich is out the door. So Sam Peckinpah ends up directing this movie himself. Getaway premieres, and despite negative reviews on its release, it does go to number one. Numerous retrospective critics have sort of come back around and given this movie a good review. It earned about $36 million. It was the eighth highest grossing film of 1972. One of the most financially successful films of Peckinpah and McQueen's careers. There is a film remake from 1994 starring Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger. I've never seen that one either. So anyone who knows let me know. I don't have a Roger Ebert review for this, but if it's Steve McQueen, I'm sure he liked it. I'm sure he liked it just fine. Yeah. This is like from an era of movies that I feel like if I caught them on TV, I might not change the channel. But I don't know. I don't know that I'm going out of my way to go watch The Getaway in 2023.
Yeah, no, I feel the same.
Okay, so once you leave the movie theater, you can get back in your car and you can drive home. And as you turn on the radio, you can listen to the number one song in America, Me and Mrs. Jones by Billy Paul.
Me and Mrs. Jones. We got a thing going on. Mm-hmm.
yourself know that it's wrong. This is a single included on the album 360 Degrees of Billy Paul. Great album title, Billy. It became Paul's only number one single on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. It was there for 3 weeks. Billy Paul would win a Best R&B Vocal Performance at the 15th Grammy Award. So Grammy Award.
For really?
Yeah, I didn't even know about him. Great for him.
Yeah.
2009, Essence Magazine included this song in their list of 25 best slow jams of all time. Reviewing the song for Stereo Gum in 2019, Tom Breehan said, "It is a finely observed song, one that never judges its characters or imagines a way out of its situation." In his obituary for Billy Paul, New York Times reporter William Grimes wrote, "The arrangement has been described as having a lush string arrangement and punchy horn parts, complementing Mr. Paul's velvety, husky baritone, which built from a near whisper at the beginning of the song to a retching, drawn out shout of me and Mrs. Jones at climactic points. Insert audio here. While the jukebox plays a favorite song, me and Mrs. Jones. So there you go. I can't believe I've never heard of Billy Paul.
Neither have I. I'm gonna have to sit down and investigate his
discography. I gotta go take a look at
this. Yeah, I'm gonna have to check it all out.
After you get home, you can settle in on the couch, and instead of watching TV, you can open up one of the weirdest books I've ever read about, the number one book in America, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Randall, have you
ever
heard
of
the
title
before?
Right, Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
Yeah, it's not the author, that's the title, Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Okay, are you ready for this?
I think I have heard of it, but I know I haven't read it.
You know, I know that people are on drugs in the world we live in today. I've seen it. People are on drugs, turns out, in the world we live in today. But this is proof that people were also on drugs, a lot of drugs, in 1972. This is written by American author Richard Bach. It is an illustrated black and white photo plus novel sort of situation. It is an allegorical fable about a seagull who is trying to learn about flying, personal reflection, freedom, and self-realization. It's from the point of view of the seagull, you see.
Okay.
It's first published in 1970 with little advertising, but by the end of 1972, over 1 million copies are in print.
Wow.
The book having reached the number one bestseller spot, mostly by word of mouth. People are just like, I can't believe it. You got to read this allegorical fable about a seagull that's learning about flight and reflection and self-realization. Stunning. What's even more stunning is that in 1973, this was turned into a film. There's a film version of this as well.
Okay.
There's a Jonathan Livingston Seagull movie. The film's voice actors include James Francisius. I don't even know if that's a person I've ever heard of in the title role. Whereas the original novel's a success, the film is a very poorly received version of this. People do not like, they do not like this movie. But this is where your favorite part of this is going to come in. And I'm excited for this. The soundtrack, which is written and recorded by Neil Diamond, is a It is a huge critical and commercial success, which earns Neil Diamond a Grammy Award and a Golden Globe.
Sing is a song in search of a voice that is silent, and the sun god will make.
That must have been how I've heard of Jonathan Livingston Seagull. Yes. I mean, you know my affinity for Neil Diamond.
I was so happy when I read this. I've never been so happy when I'm looking through the Jonathan Livingston Seagull section. And I'm like, where can I find talk about this insane novel? Oh my God, it's Neil Diamond.
Neil Diamond?
I didn't have an Ebert review for The Getaway, but I do have one for the Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He awards it 1 out of 4 stars. Roger Ebert goes on to say that he walked out of this movie after 45 minutes, making it one of only four films he has ever walked out on. The other three, True Loved, The Statute, and Caligula. So there you go. There's quite a Mount Rushmore of films. Here's what he said. This has to be the biggest pseudo-cultural, would-be metaphysical ripoff of the year. Gene Siskel gives it 1.5 stars. The dumbest, most patronizing movie of this or any year.
Or any year. Wow.
You know, wow. Sometimes it's hard to do these pop culture time capsules because the pop culture from these eras is so bad. Just terrible.
Yeah.
But sometimes it just writes itself, guys. I don't even have
sometimes
to do anything.
Sometimes it's a gem. Yeah. This is amazing. Amazing.
Jonathan Livingston Seagull. That whole concept probably deserves its own podcast series. Seagulls
I think
out of
so.
Time. Yeah, yeah. All right. That's probably enough precursor for us to get into this week's episode. You're in the right headspace here for 1972. Let's get into the sad, but I honestly feel life-affirming story of one of the most underreported, amazing baseball players in the sport's history, the great, the legend, Roberto Clemente. All right, Randall, back the meat and potatoes, the research section, the things I'm always the most excited about for a new season. And let's get into it, and let's get all the way back with Roberto Clemente. And I guess I'm going to tell the listeners what I tell my students at the start of the year. I don't grade them on pronunciation when they say stuff to me, when they get names wrong. So
that's fair. That's fair.
So I'm going to hope that our listeners try not to hold these things against me when I butcher pronunciations for any of these things. That's my hope. I'm trying my best is what I'm saying.
Yes, I get it.
So Roberto Clemente was born in Barrio San Antone in Carolina, Puerto Rico, to his mother, Luisa Walker, and Melanchor Clemente. He's the youngest of seven siblings. Three were from his mother's previous marriage, and during his childhood, Roberto Clemente's father worked as a foreman for the sugarcane crops located in the area, the northeast of the island. Because the family's limited resource, they were they're poor, poverty-stricken. Sure. Clemente and his brothers worked alongside his father's in the fields, unloading and loading trucks. I know we just started, but this is where I have to take a quick segment to do our first of two Mr. Familaro's History Corners about this story. Because, as I've mentioned probably already in the introduction, I went to college, and one of my majors in college was Latin American revolutions in the 19th and 20th century. So a lot of my time was learning about this era of Latin America. Yeah, so this is a big part of what I learned in college. Okay. So, because Clemente is born in Puerto Rico, we should understand, and works in the sugar fields, we should understand the history of how this came to be. The very brief colonial history of Puerto Rico. So, Spain itself started the sugar plantation system about two decades after the colonization of Puerto Rico. So, from 1493 to 1898, about 780 different plantations dedicated to agriculture rose up around the island. It's the major industry of the island in the way that in America early on it was lumber and then tobacco.
Help us understand how sugar is connected to the origins of American slavery.
Sugar was the most dominant economic incentive for European colonization of the Americas. No other crop was as abundant or successful in drawing Europeans to these shores, and I mean by that North America and South America, for the purpose of cultivating sugar for a worldwide market, and particularly...
Treaty of Paris in 1893 forced Spain to give up Puerto Rico to the United States, which allowed the United States to appoint a civilian governor under what was then the Foraker Act. You don't need to worry about that. What you need to worry about is the name. Charles Herbert Allen is the man they make the civilian governor, and they place the island under American military rule. Okay. Look, I can just be straightforward about this. Charles Allen is a very corrupt businessman. He's just super corrupt, man. There's nothing else I can say about it, right? Okay. Like, shocking, I know, in this era, of all things, in this economy.
Yeah.
So Allen's a very corrupt businessman, and he has really no background in government practices or policies. He is there as a businessman to slash the expenses. He refuses to use the budget surplus to make essential infrastructure and educational investments. Instead, he takes that money and instead redirects it to no-bid contracts for his U.S. businessmen friends. Stop me if any of this sounds familiar to anything ever that you've ever heard. So, in a single year that Allen was governor, he appointed half of the offices in the government to visiting Americans, about 626 of them, and nearly all of the executive council was former U.S. citizens, U.S. Expatriates. So that's where we're starting here. I'm sorry. It's going to be a tough one.
Move this man!
1901, Allen resigns as governor. He goes to Wall Street and he joins J.P. Morgan and Company. He becomes the vice president of the, I'm going to screw this up, Guarantee Trust Company. I think that's how it's not spelled. Yeah. As their first vice president in 1907, he creates the world's largest sugar syndicate in Puerto Rico, known as the American Sugar Refining Company, which they just called the Sugar Trust. The Sugar Trust owned and controlled 98% of the sugar processing capacity in the United States. Allen's political appointees provided him with land grants and tax subsidies and all these water rights and railroad and everything you could ever want. So by 1930, Allen and his partners converted 45% of all the land into sugar plantations, which explains why Roberto Clemente, which is actually what we're talking about, I promise, guys, and his family are stuck in Puerto Rico working on these farms, loading and unloading trucks. One other thing you should know about this, that syndicate, American Sugar, the American Sugar Refining Company, aka the Sugar Trust, today, that syndicate is known by a different name that you probably know. It's called Domino Sugar. So if you've ever had...
Really?
Yeah, Domino Sugar. So really what I wanted to show here more than anything else is not just the backstory of Clemente's life and how he was connected to this in Puerto Rico, but this connection between the United States and Latin America that has existed in strange ways between... Going all the way back to our founding, honestly, yeah. I would promote the book by I'm going to screw up his name. It's a book called Empire's Workshop, which talks a lot about how U.S. connections in Latin America were built during this era. But this will play on at the end when we talk about Clemente's humanitarian efforts in Nicaragua in the 1970s. So I'm sorry for history corner number one. Have you fallen asleep, Randall?
Not at all. I just have to remember Charles Herbert Allen. That's on the test.
Herbert. Yeah,
okay,
highlight and underline.
Okay,
Charles Herbert Allen.
Got it.
And Domino
Sugar Trust,
AKA
maybe
Sugar Trust.
Okay, got it.
If I were a truant boy out for a good time, I'd be right here, the Springfield Natural History Museum. You're mine, Simpson. Why, there are no children here at the 4-H Club either. Am I so out of touch? No. It's the children who are wrong.
That hurt me emotionally. I want you to know that hurt my chest just now to make it.
So let's get feel like you're in class right now.
Like I was back at work. It was like there will be not be guided notes. So Clemente, let's get back to Roberto Clemente. Again, baseball has always been particularly popular in Latin America. Even today, it's probably the number one place where is the only place in the world outside of a few places in Europe where baseball is still the number one sport. Yeah, in America, football still sort of dominates. But Clemente first showed some interest early in his life playing against neighborhood kids in the barrios. In high school, he participated in track and field, so primarily high jump, javelin throw. He was considered at a time good enough to represent Puerto Rico at the Olympics. He later stated that throwing the javelin actually helped to strengthen his arm with his footwork and release. I'll take his word for it. That makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense.
Despite his all-around athletic skill, he decided to focus on baseball and would join Puerto Rico's amateur league, joining the Ferdinand Juncos team, who represent the municipality of Juncos. I hope I'm saying that right. He began his career at the age of 18. This is 1952, when he accepted a contract with a team who we're just going to call the Crabbers for the sake of keeping it simple. Crabbers,
and it's fun. Yeah. They're fun.
It's fun. Yeah, the Crabbers.
Fun name.
They're actually called... Cangrejeros de Centrus, but I'm just going to call them Crabbers. The Winter League team and the franchise of the Puerto Rican Professional Baseball League Again, about the highest level baseball that they have in Puerto Rico at this time.
Okay.
He's a bench player during the first season. He's promoted to the starting lineup the next year, so 1953. While playing in this league, the Brooklyn Dodgers start to reach out to him, offering him, very early on, the Dodgers are sniffing around and they're offering him a $10,000 to $15,000 bonus and a $5,000 league minimum salary. And this sounds great to Roberto Clemente. So he signs with them on February 19th, 1954. That's right. He signs with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Wow.
A little strange, right? A little odd. It's not how I thought that first part would end.
Well, the Dodgers, this is what, 7 years after Jackie Robinson debuted?
Yeah.
1947. So, you know, integration is probably slowly making its way through the major leagues.
I'm glad you said that because I was actually just watching the Sports Century ESPN documentary about Roberto Clemente when we were getting into this. And I think for a lot of folks who don't think about Clemente in this way, a really easy and simple baseline way to think about Roberto Clemente today is he is the Latin American Jackie Robinson in Latin America. We'll talk about it later on, but that's an easy connection to make. He has that sort of same impact for a different community of people. So,
you've won Rookie of the Year, you've been MVP, you've won World Series. Where does the Clemente Award stack up for you?
It's out there. It's probably one or two, but it's pretty special, you know, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, what Roberto Clemente means to all the Latin America. He's kind of like, for us, the Babe Ruth, the Jackie Robinson. I think what struck me the most is with the platform that he was using, you know, to serve others. And, you know, that...
All right, let's get into his minor league career. Some of my favorite kind of baseball, lower league, minor league baseball, some of the best. At the time of his signing, the bonus rule was implemented by Major League Baseball, and that is still in effect. All right, folks, get ready for some nerd stuff. When a team signed a player to a signing bonus that was more than $4,000, that team was required to keep that player on their active roster for two full seasons. If you didn't do that, you lost the rights to the player's contract and the player would be sent to the waiver wire.
Okay.
So weird little nerd fact that's going to play in here.
I bet. I can see.
The Dodgers decided against benching Clemente and placed him with the Montreal Royals in AAA and instructed manager Max McCone to use Clemente as sparingly as possible to prevent him from actively being drafted in the Rule 5 draft. This was affected early on by... He sort of struggled early on with both the climate, from going from a Latin American climate to an American climate, and also with a language barrier, which we'll get to later, but journalists didn't make any easier on him. Clemente received assistance from a lot of bilingual teammates during this period, including infielder Chico Fernandez and pitchers Tommy Lasorda and Joe Black. We have to talk about Joe Black for just a second. He's one of the important people in this story. Black was the original target of the Pittsburgh Pirates in the 1954 scouting trip. So during this scouting trip, Clemente doesn't play. And one of the scouts, and a very important figure, Clyde Suckforth, great name, Suckforth, that looks like Suckforth, I would imagine.
Probably. I think he'd appreciate Suckforth.
I think he appreciates Suckforth. Had his suspicions that were further heightened by manager Max McCone's dismissive remarks. What do you mean you want to look at that guy? I don't know what you're talking about. What, don't pay attention. You're here to see Joe Black. Stop looking at Roberto Clemente. And the fact that Clemente was taking batting practice with the pitchers rather than his fellow position players. So Suckforth is a little curious. He feels that something is up here, right? So he starts making inquiries and soon asserts that Clemente's status is that he is an unprotected player. So Suckforth recalls later saying, I knew he would be our first draft choice. I knew we were taking him first. So I told the manager to take good care of our boy and see that he doesn't get hurt. During the follow-up visit, Suckforth says, I don't care if you never play him once. We're going to finish dead last, and we are taking Roberto Clemente at number one. So this ruse to keep him in is not working. It's very clear, even early on, that he has elite-level skills and teams are onto it. That starts showing in July of 1954. Clemente hit an extra-inning walk-off home run, the first of his North American baseball career, in his first at-bat after entering the game as a defensive replacement. So the first time he really gets a chance.
Right.
This appearance ended a nearly two-month-long drought starting from June 6th. From this point forward, Clemente playing his playing time would increase significantly, finishing the season with a 257 average in only 87 games. At the end of the season, he returned to play for the Crabbers alongside then teammate Willie Mays, surprisingly. Yeah. As promised, the Pirates made Clemente the very first selection of the Rule 5 draft that took place on November 22nd, 1954. So here we are. Okay. Finally, Clemente is with the Pirates.
I had got the job to work in Pittsburgh in May of 66, and Jimmy Cannon was one of the fellows that recommended me for the job in Pittsburgh. He says to me, you know, you're going to a town that might have the best player in baseball and nobody knows.
Mays and Aaron and Mantle were hitting the home runs, so they captivated the media, and it kind of overshadowed Roberto a lot.
He was a tremendous ball player.
So, right, so that's, if he signed in February, he only played that one season with Montreal, looks like, and then the Pirates went in and scooped him up, because he wasn't on the roster. Is that why?
Yeah, that believes to be the case. Again, it's a little nerdy, so baseball fans who might know a little deeper on this can feel free to reach out to us on it. Yeah. Uh-huh. There's only one other thing I want to mention before we actually get into his major league career, but I do feel it's significant because it will play into some injury concerns that he had later on. In 1954, this is not in our notes, by the way. In 1954, Roberto Clemente suffered a injury in a car accident that would lead to lower back problems that would sort of persist throughout his entire career. That's just sort of one little thing to keep in mind when we talk about his injuries. But the other one is this. In September of 1958, Clemente joined the United States Marine Corps Reserve. He served for 6 months as an active duty commitment. Clemente received recruit training with Platoon 346 and the 3rd Recruit Battalion. This rigorous Marine training program helped Clemente physically. He added strength. He gained 10 pounds of muscle and said his back troubles, which were caused by this car accident, had started to decrease. So it was his time in the military, he said, that helped to deal with some of these early back problems that he suffered. He was a first class. He was a private first class in the Marine Corps, and he stayed essentially in the Marine Corps until September 1964, which I think is wild for a professional athlete. You'd never see it today, right?
Totally different era. I mean, that's essentially what it was. I mean, you had all those guys who fought in World War II, and then you know this is obviously after World War II, but yeah, that's a bygone era. It really
the
is.
The closest thing I can think of is that you can look at Tottenham Football Club star Heung-min Song, who's a Korean player.
Yeah,
he did have to go back to Korea for 1 year of like mandatory military service or military training. And then they did release him back to the Premier League. But he got like the Elvis treatment, right? Like he went there and he was a star.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, thanks
he was
a lot.
Already
and
then, a star.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Right.
All right. Let's get into it. Let's get into his major league baseball career. I just want to ask, because Randall, you've told me in private, and I think we've talked about it last season, that when you were growing up, the Pirates were a pretty formative team for you, like career, like growing up. Yeah.
Now, yeah, absolutely.
You were not. I don't know. Was Clemente part of that? Was that part of the mystique that you knew as a kid or no?
No, actually, it wasn't because he had, you know, unfortunately, he. Spoiler alert, he ends up dying pretty young.
Spoiler alert.
So he had actually passed before I was even born. So the Pirates that I grew up like following, they were the 1970s Pirates with Willie Stargell, Dave Parker, you know, people like that, Bill Madlock. And they were winning World Series and they were very competitive. But they, you know, some of those guys played with Roberto Clemente in the early part of their careers. It wasn't because of Roberto Clemente that I followed him, but, you know, but after that, as I got older, I started to kind of like want to know more about Roberto Clemente.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's get into the major league stuff and let's start with the early career. Again, Pirates. I tend to think of them as one of the iconic baseball teams. Me and Justin were having a debate about which are the most iconic baseball teams in all of the history of baseball. Okay. Pirates feel like one of them to me. I think just so much history, and I think the colors really helped too, the uniform.
Absolutely. And the crazy uniforms that they've always
had. Crazy uniforms. Pirates struggled in the early 1950s through a lot of difficult seasons. When Clemente debuted in April 17th, 1955 against the Brooklyn Dodgers, ironically, early in his career, he was frustrated by racial and ethnic tensions. He was sniping with the local media. Some of the teammates, some of the teammates as well were also not too pleased to have him. And again, he had a sort of broken English accent. He didn't, English right. was not his first language.
Yeah.
And reporters, you know, according to the documentary stuff, reporters kind of played this up to make him seem like an idiot, to make him seem right. dumber or right. lesser than. So early on, he was not particularly beloved, even by his entire teammates and many mm-hmm. of the local media.
As part of the first large Latino wave to play in the majors, Puerto Rican Roberto Clemente faced a language and cultural barrier that played out in the Pittsburgh sports pages of 1955 in derision, ignorance, and bad taste.
He'd use a phrase, say, like, I hit the ball, and they would print H-E-E-T instead of H-I-T.
They quoted him as though he were Tarzan.
This is also something I've noticed. I grew up, you know, playing, working with lots of Latin American dudes.
Yeah.
In America, if you walk up to somebody and you go, "Hey, how you doing today?" They go, "Good." And then you walk away. Right. Sure. Cause you don't sure. really want to know how they're doing.
Right.
That's a colloquialism. We just say that. Hey, how's it mm-hmm. going? How you doing?
Yeah.
In other cultures, they don't do that. So if you walk up to someone from another culture and say, "Hey, how you feeling?" They're going to tell you, because they assume you're asking how they're actually feeling. So one of the things Clemente struggled with is people would say, "Hey, how's it going?" And he would say, "My back is bad. My arm is bad. My leg is bad." And they're like, "This guy's a complainer." It's like, well, you sure, asked sure. him. You asked him. all right. So I just wanted to get some of that in, because that was sort of the early struggles in terms of how he related to it. Clemente responded to all this in his own sort of way. He said, "I don't believe in color." He said that during his upbringing, he was taught never to discriminate against anyone based on ethnicity. So Clemente was at a double disadvantage. He's both a Latin American and a mm-hmm. Caribbean player, and his first language is Spanish, and was of partially African descent. So he's dealing with lots of different levels sure. of society here, right?
What also stung deep were the constant lampoons of his broken English.
He would say things like, bad shoulder feels good, but my good shoulder feels bad, or I feel better when I am sick. And the sports writers would write this as comedy, and he was deadly serious, and he resented that.
He was accused of malingering, that he imagined a lot of illnesses.
The year before, the Pirates had hired a guy named Kurt Roberts, their first African-American player. They were the ninth team in the major leagues to do so, 7 years after Jackie Robinson. Yeah. When Clemente arrived, Kurt Roberts befriended him and helped him sort of adjust to life in the major leagues, as well as to living in the Pittsburgh area. Just for some context, folks, the players who Clemente would be out there playing against in Major League Baseball around this time are names like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Mickey Mantle. So this is the kind of era that he's stepping into during the time, like some of the greatest years of baseball yeah. superstars of all time.
Sure.
During his rookie season, Clemente sat out several games after suffering a lower back injury in Puerto Rico that previous winter. This car accident we sort yep. of talked about. A speeding drunk driver rammed into his car at an intersection, and he finished that rookie season with a .255 batting average, despite trouble hitting certain types of pitches and being in considerable amounts of pain.
Okay.
Following season, on July 25th, 1956, Clemente hit the only documented walk-off inside the park grand slam in Major League history, which is a stunning stat. I gotta find the highlight for this one.
Right?
Or some sort of clip, someone talking about it.
Nope. Mm-mm. Nope.
Sports writer John Steuerwald said it may have been done only once in the history of baseball. So yeah. I don't know if there's footage of this. Again, 1956. I feel like we would have seen it if there were footage.
I think you're right. I don't think there's probably footage.
Yeah. Early in the 1960 season, however, this again, 2 years after his time served with the Marines, which he said helped to alleviate a lot of those back problems. By the 1960s, Clemente is leading Major League Baseball yeah. with a 353 batting average, 14 extra base hits, and 25 RBIs just in May alone. So he is hot.
Yeah.
His batting average would remain above the 300 mark throughout the course of the campaign. On August 5th at Forbes Field, Clemente crashed into the right field wall while making a pivotal play. The resulting injury necessitated 5 stitches to his chin and a 5-game layoff for Clemente. This catch would go on as one of his more famous moments, one of his more iconic moments. Beat writer Bob Stevens ranked it as one of the greatest of all time, one of the most frightening to watch, and the most painful to make. For my generation, I feel like that was when Jeter ran into the third baseline and went face first into
this. Yeah, that's probably a good comp.
He looks at the left field, going to be a tough play. Jeter on the run, makes the play, and flies into the stands. Oh, what a play by Derek Jeter.
Wow, Jeter really banged himself up.
I think he caught you could see the redness in his face. He caught the power of that box. What a play.
Oh, my goodness.
He caught he had to know that was going to happen. I mean, it's just full tilt. There's
what I've heard and what I've seen is that Clemente played with a reckless abandon, right? He was, you know, he's giving it 100% every single day, every single play. So, I mean, this kind of makes sense, this play.
I was using a lot of the documentary footage when I was going through the research for this, and just watching him run, this is going to sound like a dig, but it's not. It's actually a compliment. He runs like a kid, just this sort of excitement, these big flailing motions. He's so 100% into it, right? It's almost scary. He's like, oh my God, slow down.
Yeah. He's like he's attacking the baseline, right? Yeah, absolutely.
The Pirates in 1960 would win the NL pennant and go on to defeat the Yankees in a 7-game World Series. Clemente batted .310 in this series, hitting safely at least once in every single game.
Mickey Mantle with two on, singles home Richardson. Suddenly the Bombers trail by only one run, and there are still two men on base. Coming up, a thrilling play. Barra's sharp grounder is grabbed by the first baseman. He makes the out, but misses, doubling up Mantle as the tying run scores. Last half of the ninth, Bill Mazeroski, first man up for the Pirates. He tags the second pitch. And there's the ball game and the World Series. A 10-9 victory on the wings of a home run they'll be talking about in Pittsburgh for years and years, even forever.
This is a weird thing. In the 1960 season, for some reason, there were two All-Star games. From 1959 through 1962, they had two All-Star games. Don't know why they did it. Seems weird.
Was one in the middle of the season, one at the end of the season?
Yeah, one at the beginning of the season, one at the end of the season, one in the middle of the season. Yeah, very strange stuff. I don't understand what baseball's plan was here. Let's move on to 1961. During spring training, which everyone loves to talk about, Clemente tried to modify his batting technique by using a heavier bat to slow the speed of his swing. Clemente was also named the starting National League right fielder for the first of two All-Star games. So there you go. I wanted to make that clear. With the American League ahead 4-3 in the 10th inning, he teamed with fellow Hall of Famers Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and Frank Robinson to engineer a come-from-behind 5-4 NL victory, culminating in Clemente's walk-off single against knuckleballer Hoyt Wilhelm, which sounds like a name that only a knuckleballer could have.
Oh, absolutely. You couldn't be a flamethrower.
This was also the season that he would receive his first Golden Glove Award. After the 1961 season, I find this kind of fascinating, too, because I can't imagine, again, with modern context, that players would do this. After the 1961 season, Clemente traveled back to Puerto Rico, where he managed the Senadores de San Juan of the Puerto Rican League. So he's playing and also managing a Puerto Rican league, as well as playing on the team during the offseason. So he's the player coach. During the winter league, Clemente injured his thigh doing some work at home, but he wanted to participate in the Puerto Rican All-Star game. He pinch hit and got a single, but he experienced a complication of an injury, and as a result, he had to go on surgery shortly after being carried off the playing field. This limited his role with the Pirates for the first half of the 1965 season, during which he batted .257. When he returned to the regular starting lineup, he got hits in 33 out of 34 games, and his batting average climbed back up to .340. Participated as a pinch hitter and replaced Willie Stargell during the All-Star game in 1965. All right, let's get into the 1970s because we're sort of getting toward the sad parts of this story. So let's look and honor the last parts of his career here, the end of his career. The 1970 season was the final season of the legendary Forbes Field before the Pirates would move to Three River Stadium, which I think is where they still are now. Yes?
No,
they're gone again.
That's there in PNC Park.
PNC Park. Yeah, that's
it's
right.
A new okay. stadium. Yeah, new no. Stadium. Three Rivers was the, you know, the basically all those like Busch Stadium and Veterans
that's right.
Stadium. They were yeah, all the yeah. same.
They're just yeah, they're templates. We're just gonna
they
plop
were.
This down.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're playing SimCity. Yeah, that's amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's actually it's funny because I guess just because that's the name of the stadium I remember watching as a kid was Three River Stadium, sort of stuck with me. So they move into Three River Stadium, and for Clemente, this was actually quite sad. Abandoning this stadium was quite emotional for him, saying it was hard to play on a different field. I spent half my life there, he said. On July 24th, 1970, that night was declared Roberto Clemente Night. A ceremony to honor Clemente took place, during which he received a scroll with 300,000 signatures compiled in Puerto Rico and several thousands of dollars, which were donated to charity work following Clemente's request. Pirates would win the NL East pennant in 1970, but were eliminated by the Cincinnati Reds.
A single by Clemente. And after a walk to Stargell, another hit by Al Oliver for the run. Bob Moose gets the call, and the Reds charge right back.
The only reason I bring up that charity night thing is you're starting to get to a point now in the 1970s mm-hmm. where Clemente is much more aware of what his impact is yeah. on other people. And he's starting to use his position and his place to give back to other people.
Yep.
All right, 1971, the Pirates win the NL pennant and face the Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. Orioles had won 101 games and were the defending World Series champions. The Orioles won the first two games in the series, but the Pirates would win the championship in seven games, winning four of the last five. This marked the second occasion that Clemente helped win a World Series for the Pirates. Over the course of the series, Clemente hit 414. Outrageous.
Yeah.
Outrageous. Performed very well defensively, hit a solo home run in the deciding 2-1 seventh game victory, and he would receive the World Series MVP award. I would say if you want to add a nice cap on this story, if you want to end mm-hmm. here on a happy note, this is it. 1971, probably his sure. greatest climactic moment in sports.
That is hit well. A Clemente home run, and the Pirates lead 1-0.
Like he hit a breaking pitch right over the plate. That's his 12th hit. He's one short now, tying Bobby Richardson's all-time World Series record of 13 hits in a seven-game World Series. He had a triple and a homer yesterday.
In 1972, he did come back, but he was frustrated and sort of struggled with injuries. He only played in 102 games. He hit .312, which is still pretty stunning for a guy who's quote-unquote struggling.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. He did make the All-Star team for the National League for the 12th time, winning his 12th consecutive Gold Glove. On September 30th, he hit a double in the fourth inning off John Matlock of the New York Mets at Three River Stadium to complete his 3,000th hit.
Matlock on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive for the gap in the left center field. There she is. For a double. Papers flying, everybody standing. A double for Roberto.
This was his last regular season at bat of his career. In the NL playoffs that season, he batted .235 as he went 4-for-17, failing to fill up to the high, lofty standards of the year before. His sure. last game was October 11th, 1972, at Cincinnati's Riverfront Stadium. In the fifth and final game of the 1972 National League Championship Series, him and Bill Mazeroski were the last Pirates players remaining from the original 1960 World Series Championship team. So that's kind of a fun fact.
Yeah, it is.
So Clemente, as you can tell from some of the stories about his time in Puerto Rico, coaching and playing, he's spending a lot of his time in the offseason doing charity work. So in 1972, on December 23rd, 1972, the capital of Nicaragua, known as Managua, is affected by a massive earthquake, a very, very big earthquake. I want to say a 7.0 earthquake. It really devastated the core of the city. He had visited Managua about 3 weeks before the quake had happened. So Clemente is already connected to this area, and he immediately set to work arranging for emergency relief funds. Sadly, he learned that these aid packages on the first three flights were being diverted by corrupt officials of the Somoza government, in particular, their leader at this time, Anastasio Somoza, a.k.a. Tacho Somoza. And these relief funds were never reaching the victims of the earthquakes. So in an effort to try and make sure that these fourth relief efforts could make it there, he decides to accompany them himself, hoping that his presence is going to ensure that it would be delivered safely to the survivors. All right. Here's where we have to get into Mr. Familaro's History Corner Part 2.
Okay.
And we need to talk about the Somoza Dynasty.
President Somoza of Nicaragua, who was recently host to the U.S. Vice President Nixon, is the victim of a would-be assassin's bullets. The assailant was killed on the spot. President Somoza was gravely wounded. Taken to hospital in the Canal Zone, he was attended by doctors rushed from the United States.
So, when I was in college and I wrote my thesis, my 33-page thesis, my thesis was called Aftershocks. That was the title. Semicolon. How the 1972 Managua earthquake sped up the fall of the Somoza government and gave rise to the Sandinistas. That's the second.
Really?
Yeah. That's what I had to write to graduate Hunter University and get my bachelor's degree in global history. That was the paper I wrote. So I took my 33-page paper and I condensed it into one paragraph that you guys can, which is also what I do for my school kids, because we never talk about this in high school. So I'll give you the very, very bare bones story of the Somoza dynasty and how this connects. Right.
Great.
Strap in, kids. So the Somoza dynasty was a family-led political regime in Nicaragua that spanned over the course of four decades, from the 1930s to the 1970s. Led by Anastasio Somoza Garcia and his descendants, this regime was marked by authoritarian rule, political repression, and widespread political corruption. The U.S. was supportive of the Somozas as they represented an anti-communist regime in Latin America.
Okay.
Remember, kids, Cold War. The downfall came in 1979 during the Nicaraguan Revolution, as a popular uprising was led by the leftist rebellion known as the Sandinistas, or the FSLN. Revolution aimed to overthrow the Somoza government and bring out social and economic reforms. After years of guerrilla warfare and civil strife, the Sandinistas successfully ousted the Somoza regime, leading to the escape of Anastasio Tacho Somoza, their then leader, in July of 1979. This marked the end of the Somoza dynasty, and it's also a major turning point, the major turning point in Nicaraguan history. When the Sandinistas established a socialist government and then reshaped the country into their political landscape, you can connect that directly to Daniel Ortega, who is the current president of Nicaragua today. So the Sandinistas are still a political force in Nicaragua, although I would be remiss to say that they are no longer following the same political ideology they did in 1979. That's a whole different story. We won't get into it.
Ortega's been at the center of Nicaraguan history for decades. He came to power as a Sandinista guerrilla commander who helped overthrow a dictatorship and became president in 1984. After losing to Violeta Chamorro in 1990, he returned to power in 2006. Over time, he consolidated power, muzzled dissent, and oversaw modest growth. But today, Nicaragua is the region's second poorest country.
The reason I bring this up is because this earthquake in 1972 that happens is sort of the catalyst event that shifts people's view of the Somozas from okay to sort of expediting this shift in their downfall. That was sort of the connection. And that's also the reason that Clemente is flying to Nicaragua here in 1972.
Got it.
That plane was chartered for the New Year's Eve flight. It's a Douglas D-67 cargo plane. This plane has a history of mechanical problems, and it also has an insufficient number of flight personnel. One flight engineer and a co-pilot are both missing. It is also overloaded by 4,200 pounds.
Jeez. Wow.
This airplane crashes into the Atlantic Ocean off of the coast of Isla Verde, Puerto Rico, almost immediately after takeoff on December 31st, 1972, due to an engine failure.
Another plane crash last night. Among five persons aboard, Pittsburgh Pirates baseball superstar Roberto Clemente.
The person that he was still lives amongst the baseball community. I don't think that should ever die.
And he took the platform of baseball and became a real humanitarian, you know, hence an award being named in his honor.
A search and rescue effort was immediately launched. A few days after, the body of the pilot and part of the fuselage on the plane were found. An empty flight case, which apparently belonged to Clemente, is the only personal item of his which has been recovered from the plane. Clemente's teammate and close friend, Manny Sanguin, was the only member of the Pirates who did not attend Roberto's memorial service. Instead, he chose to dive in the waters where Clemente's plane had crashed in an effort to find his teammate. The body of Clemente and three others were never recovered. Montreal Expos pitcher Tom Walker, then playing Winter League ball in Puerto Rico, helped him load the plane that evening. Because Clemente wanted Walker, who was single, to go and enjoy New Year's Eve, Clemente specifically told him not to come on the flight.
Oh, well, it's unbelievable.
What a wild story. In an interview for the ESPN docuseries Sports Century in 2002, Clemente's widow, Vera, mentioned that Clemente had told her that he had thought he was going to die young several times over the course of their relationship.
Hmm.
Indeed, when he was being asked when he would get his 3,000th hit by broadcaster and future Hall of Famer Richie Ashburn in 1971, Clemente responded saying, "Well, you never know. If I'm alive, like I said before, you never know, because God tells you how long you're going to be here. So you never know what could happen tomorrow." So again, there's some stuff here, but this is sort of the moment where he goes from being baseball player to cultural icon, you know, just a baseball player, this person who represented a legacy of a lot of different things.
Absolutely.
All right. So following this plane crash on March 20th, 1973, the Baseball Writers Association of America holds a special election for the Baseball Hall of Fame. First time they've done this. They voted to waive the waiting period for Clemente due to the circumstances of his death and posthumously elected him for induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame, giving him 393 out of 420 available votes, which is 92.7% of the votes. Classic baseball writer stuff, right?
Seriously, who was come on. Who is he didn't deserve it.
I like the idea, though, that not only did they not vote for him, but they didn't do it at a ceremony, a special ceremony.
Yeah.
That was specially set. Like, you came here for this reason. It's like, no, I have to make my case. He didn't wait the 5 years.
Right. He's a Hall of Famer, but is he a first ballot Hall of Famer?
He's got to pay his dues. You know, he's got to wait it out like everybody else does.
Come on.
God, it's such hilarious baseball writer stuff. That made me chuckle when I was looking at this. Clemente's career was very profound and had a lasting impact on lots of different levels, both kind of inside baseball and, as we talked about, with all his volunteer work and community service, obviously beyond. I tried to limit this down to a couple bullet points, teacher style, but here's where I'm going to stand on a few things. So,
okay.
Number one, representation, integration. Again, we sort of talked about him as Latin American Jackie Robinson, right? As a Puerto Rican player, he was facing discrimination, language barriers. He would pave the way for other Latin players to join and succeed in the league. He's, again, deified. You know, look at these documentaries. Yeah. He is treated in that way in Latin American countries, the gateway, the symbol for the best of us who could be if we only try hard enough.
I think, you know, as a player, you stay focused on, you know, you get this platform that God has given you. You get the blessing to have a great career. But what are you going to do with that? And with Hang, it was about giving back always and care about not just here in the city of Pittsburgh, you know, but back in Latin America, Puerto Rico, you know, and everywhere that he went, he left his footprint, and that's something that is pretty special for all of us. It doesn't matter where you come from, Venezuela, Mexico, Puerto Rico, Dominican.
Simply from a humanitarian effort, his impact extends beyond baseball. All those humanitarian efforts, committing to both his home country in Puerto Rico and other Latin American countries like we saw in Nicaragua. Again, pushing forward this idea of being successful and using that wealth and success to give back both to your community and to the outside world. Great, you know, great things we should all aspire to. Clemente becomes a cultural icon, again, not just in the baseball world. He's celebrated annually. There's Roberto Clemente Day in Major League Baseball. The Roberto Clemente Foundation was created in response to his death in order to continue his humanitarian work. They provide scholarships and disaster relief and support to underserved communities. He's a very inspiring figure, honestly, just for most athletes. I mean, it's hard sometimes when we look at the story of athletes, and especially on this show, when we look for athletes who have weird backstories where someone genuinely seems like a really wonderful person, like a truly shining example, right?
Absolutely.
And again, that's kind of where I land on this. You know, this is, again, one of those early examples of stars who uses that platform to, like, social change, helping out other people. We're going to shape the world through sports and philosophy. This is the opposite of the stick to sports conversation that we see people having all the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. He was the first Latin American to get into the Hall of Fame.
That's correct. Very first.
He's, you know, referred to as kind of like the Latin American Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
Right. He was their first great, great player. And, you know, I think his personal life doesn't mirror Babe Ruth's, because Babe Ruth's was much different. You're right. I mean, I was watching, unfortunately, even though he's an icon, a cultural icon, an inspirational figure, I don't think there's enough about him, right? There's not enough said about him, enough done about him. I don't know why there hasn't been a movie made about him. That's how I feel, because I still want to know more, right? There's not like the definitive, right, documentary on Roberto Clemente.
Well, I think that word definitive sticks out, because one of the things I noticed when I heard people talking about this is, because of the sort of mystery, of his death, like that they never found him, there is this sort of air of sadness and mystery that lingers, and it feels like an unclosed story to a lot of people, I think, right? Like,
sure,
it ended before it was supposed to, and it felt like it shouldn't have. And there seems to be a lot of players, both people and players and people he knew, who were unwilling to accept that it happened. They had to go and had to see for themselves, you know? So,
And he died at the young age of 38. I mean, his career was, you know, obviously winding down, but he's still a young man.
And of course, before we move away from our conversation about Roberto Clemente, what was that? Oh, I did have to reach out to our returning third host for the first time this season. That's right. ChatGPT.
The Skynet funding bill is passed. The system goes online on August 4th, 1997. Human decisions are removed from strategic defense. Skynet begins to learn at a geometric rate. It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern
time. ChatGPT held out for a new contract for season 2. So we re-upped.
We re-upped.
I don't know if we can afford ChatGPT going forward, because we make no money on this.
I almost pulled a Chris Jones and made him wait one episode before he came back to let him know we didn't really need him. But then I didn't want to lose the first game.
Then realized we really needed him.
We really needed him. I asked ChatGPT before this. ChatGPT, can you give me some modern baseball players with a similar profile to Roberto Clemente? And here is what he said, or she. It's sexless. It's a robot.
Right.
While there may not be an exact equivalent to Clemente's style and impact, a few modern players have drawn comparisons in terms of their skill, character, and community involvement. Here are a couple of players who have been mentioned in the past in relation to Clemente. The first is Andrew McCutchen, who has been lauded for his on-field skills, including power, speed, defense. He's also known for his charismatic personality, community engagement, especially in the Pittsburgh area, which drew comparison to Clemente's dedication to helping others. I think the Pittsburgh play also plays in there a little bit.
I think you're right. That's a big part of it. But you know, I think he embraced that as well, McCutcheon.
For sure. And you have to be, you have to be a certain kind of person who's willing to embrace that too. Yeah, not everyone's absolutely. Willing to.
For sure.
In that way, let's talk about the person I feel like is the biggest outlier on ChatGPT's list. Yasiel Puig. Remember Yasiel Puig?
Oh yeah.
In terms of raw, in terms of raw talent, Puig's arm strength, speed, and exciting style of play have occasionally drawn up comparisons to Clemente. Occasionally. However, it's worth noting that Puig's career has been somewhat inconsistent. That's very generous. Somewhat. Yeah, it's super generous. And he has achieved nowhere near the same level of sustained success. So he's taken, this is like an, he's like, I'm going to throw a curveball in here. This is like a dark horse candidate.
I think what ChatGPT is trying to say, and I'm not trying to speak for you, ChatGPT, but Yasiel Puig had the talent, but no work ethic.
Yeah.
Right. The talent, but not the work ethic of a Roberto Clemente. Possibly. Well, yeah.
Right, in terms of raw talent, the raw talent.
Yeah, raw talent. Yeah.
And then two younger guys, Francisco Lindor. Lindor is known for his outstanding defensive skills as a shortstop, and he's been recognized for his positive attitude and community involvement. While his playing style may differ from Clemente's, his commitment to play the game and making a positive impact in the community has drawn parallels in the past. And then finally, Ronald Acuna Jr., who possesses a combination of power, speed, and defensive skills that make him an exciting player to watch in the field.
Yeah.
And his dynamic style of play and potential for impact on and off the field could draw some parallels to Clemente in the future. So I think they're taking a flyer on Acuna Jr.
Acuna smashes this to center. Don't even bother chasing it. My goodness. A homer in all three games in the series. And Ronald Acuna saying, MVP, that sounds pretty good to me. 454.
Ronald's quickly become a villain out here in LA. What do you think?
Yep. And he doesn't mind it one bit.
I think that's a pretty good flyer to take.
Yeah.
He's a dynamic young player. And the same thing with Lindor. I think both of those are pretty good comparisons. Lindor might be even more spot on because Acuna's got a little more power, and Clemente only hit what a little over 200 and some odd homers. He wasn't a big power guy, but I think those are pretty good comparisons.
ChatGPT did want to tell us to remember that player comparisons do change over time as their players' careers progress, and that impact becomes more apparent as time goes on.
Additionally, I think he's hedging.
He also says, and this is great commentary. Additionally, there may be new rising stars in baseball who have emerged since my last update in 2021. So I guess you could mark down what Shohei Ohtani, was he not on this list 2 years ago? and I guess that's where I guess we can leave it here for the research section. We'll jump back into some other things. Randall, I hope I didn't bore you too much with history content here.
Added to the story with your history lessons. For sure.
I think you said something though earlier that I've been thinking about since you said it. And I think it's right. I wonder why Clemente hasn't gotten the post-career coverage of some other great players of this era, because the story is fascinating and captivating in the same way as a lot of these other players.
Absolutely. And that's, I don't understand it. I don't have that answer. I don't know. Because it does seem, because you know what I watched about him. One of the documentaries that I watched, there was a clip from the gentleman that helped him pack the plane. What was his name again?
Oh, Tom Walker.
Tom Walker.
Tom Walker.
Yeah, who played with him and knew him, and you know this documentary was probably done 20 years ago, but that's still 30 years after the accident, let's say. And you could see the real pain on his face to that day. Yep. Right. You're like, he still was like, it's the worst. He's like, I probably was the last person that survived. Right. He wasn't on the plane to talk to him. And, you know, and he said that, you know, he was full of life but his heart was bigger than anything that he did on the field. It's like those are the types of people we should be celebrating, right? is exactly people that do have these huge hearts and are very successful and want to give back. And I don't know. I just wish there was more about him. I really do.
Well, I think you're right. And that's why we did this one, folks, to put a little more about absolutely. Roberto Clemente out there into
Thank
the
you,
world.
Sam.
Hey, my great pleasure. Let's get to some more topical stuff in just a second.
Yeah.
Right. That was a fun episode for any, you know, all these episodes are sad or sad. I get it. Like, but I like talking about Clemente. Like, I think it's an interesting story and I like hearing about his life and his career. So I don't find it as sad as maybe the, you know, the end of it turns out to be.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's I learned a lot and I think that I'm glad that you did it because I think it was well deserved. As far as Roberto and his career and his legacy and his life.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And look, we'll have lots of episodes coming up this year. I've looked at the slate for stuff we got coming up. I promise you, there'll be some things you've never heard of. There's going to be some stuff you've never heard of.
Oh yeah.
We got some stuff for you. But yeah, I had a lot of fun doing this. Before we close up, I know we like to talk a little topical sports. And again, sure. I like to never lie to the people. I'm a good guy. I'm always telling the truth. Even when I lie, I always tell the truth. You know, and I like to keep it honest. You know, we had talked about when we were going to release these episodes. And I always think it's interesting when I look back at what I had written at the time for what we were going to talk about that seemed topical. And
yes.
And just for keeping with conversation's sake, here are the things that I thought we were going to talk about when we recorded this this part of the podcast. The NFL preseason has just begun. What do you think the Bills and Bears chances are?
Well, I would have said the Bills are going to start 1-4 and the Bears are going to be undefeated. That's what I would have said.
Yeah, if we're being honest, that's what you would have said. Yeah, right. I mean, I don't want to get – even by the time this episode comes out, the records will be different. I think at the moment the Bills are 3-2 and I think the Bears are 1-4 as we speak on this day, whatever it is. How are you – I guess we talked about it off air, but how are you feeling about your beloved Chicago Bears here in 2023?
Well, heading into week 6, I guess, right?
As we're 6-7. Recording this.
The Bears are going to be at a crossroads. Either Fields is the guy or he isn't, because Caleb Williams is looming as the number one, you know, presumptive number one pick. Right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, for sure.
He's
probably
going to be a 2-time Heisman Trophy winner. So, you know, the reality is, Fields in the last game in 3 quarters has played really, really well.
It's true.
Yeah. But can he do that for 12 more games? And of course there's a whole, you know, with the NFL, there's all these other things that play into it. You know, you can reset a quarterback on a rookie contract if you get a new one and let Fields go. Otherwise you're going to have to pay Fields in the next couple of years, like massive money. Right. Like Daniel Jones type money, which is a waste of money. $40 million a year.
That was a real sneaky drive by in Daniel Jones right there, by the way. That was pretty.
I don't think I told a lie.
But, shout out to my stepdad.
But, those are the things that obviously the Bears and people way smarter than me will figure out. How about you? What about the Bills?
At this moment, heading into week 7, Bills are 3-2. They are wildly predictable. This is classic Bills. Tale as old as time. They'll go as far as Josh Allen can take them. They've already lost their two best defensive players, seemingly for the year, which are Tre'Davious White and Milano, getting carted out last week. So already I'm in that's that, right? That's the end. Like, they'll be good enough to make, and I don't mean that to be negative, but they're going to make the playoffs, presumably, because the AFC does not look particularly good. They're definitely going to win. Right. Unless Allen gets hurt, they'll win at least 10 or 11 games because they're good and he's talented, right? Are they going to beat the Chiefs? I don't know. Are they going to beat the Dolphins? I don't know. None of these teams seem very good right now. So I feel a bit meh about the whole situation, to be honest.
You think I'm not being sincere here in Buffalo, New York? in front of all these grotesque poor lard asses who have quite possibly the worst football team in the history of the United States of America?
He's back. He's back.
Can only keep up the facade for so long, Taz.
Kind of speechless here.
Ah,
well, there goes that Josh Allen jersey. Go Jets.
Josh Allen sucks.
Give it a couple more weeks. We'll see where the Bills are. I'd like to see them beat the Giants this weekend and be 4-2, and I'll feel a lot better. So by the time people hear this, if the Bills are 4-2, I'll be okay. And if they're 3-3, I'll be annoyed. That's where I am. Yeah. Must win. Must win against the Giants on Sunday night.
I think the Giants are a get right game, so you'll be okay.
I hope so. Let's see. What else was on the slate to talk about? Ooh, I was going to do a whole bit about the Women's World Cup, but that seems very dated now.
Open wide for some soccer!
The Continental Soccer Association is coming to Springfield. It's all here. Fast kicking, low scoring, and ties. You bet.
Extremely dated.
Extremely dated.
Extremely dated. I would tell you one thing about the Women's World Cup that I actually watched quite a bit of it.
Yeah.
Because I was pulling for after the U.S. was, you know, clearly out of it.
Yep.
I was pulling for Australia only because they call themselves the Matildas.
Yes.
And as you know, my dog's name is Matilda.
Yes.
So, yeah. So I was rooting for Australia.
I was rooting for anybody but England, but I just kept singing that It's Coming Home song for days and days and days about how it's coming home. It's coming home. It's coming. I won't get into Premier League. Premier League's going quite well. It's been a good start to the season. I don't feel like talking about Liverpool that much. They're in contention. It's been a fun season, and I've missed a lot of it so far. The only thing I guess we should bring up before we close up here for today is we are right in the middle of baseball playoffs. I don't have any notes on this, so we're just riffing on this.
Yeah, I don't either.
Have you watched any of this baseball playoff? I watched the Orioles get eliminated last night, so that'll tell you when we recorded this. Kind of sad. Are you sad or happy that the Orioles didn't do more in the playoffs here?
No, that saddened me. I was rooting for the Orioles to do something. But you know, the reality is the Rangers were obviously playing very well. And Bruce Bochy, he knows how to manage a baseball team. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Do you think that there's something to this, like, if you have to wait a week to play, like was it a disadvantage for the Orioles to have to sit that week and wait for the Rangers?
That's obviously a topic of discussion on, in sports media. I don't know. I mean, it might be. I think for a young team like the Orioles, it probably didn't do them any favors. But if it was a team like the Astros, I don't think that's going to hurt them, right? They've been there, done that. They know what they're doing. But it seems to be hurting the Dodgers, who are obviously a veteran team, and the Diamondbacks seem to have their number right now. It's not done yet. But I think for young teams it might be at a disadvantage, but for more experienced teams, they should be able to manage that, because the Braves should be managing that. And I think they're what, up 2-1 now?
2-1, 2-1 in the series. I think the Astros are up 2-1 right now as we think about it. I don't know. I'm trying to get excited about this baseball playoffs, and it has been good. I watched some of the games last night. Again, without the Yankees, my first thought as a diehard homer Yankee fan was like, Orioles get swept in the first round. Yankees could have done that. we do that all the time. Well, that happens right. It's pretty regular for us now.
Well, all the AL East teams got swept. So,
that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, not just the Orioles. It was the Rays and the Jays. Yeah, you know, I was traveling for work in Minneapolis last week, and that's when the Twins won, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they need to thank me for that. The Twins and the DS is all my doing.
Yeah, that's all you're doing. It's very good.
I expect some credit there. So, yeah.
Before we go too, I was just going to bring up one last thing. Since I introduced it to you, and I'm sure that listeners would be interested as well. I've been pushing the Immaculate Grid on almost every sports fan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I talked to you about it a few weeks ago. Have you been playing it? Are you still in on it, or are you out?
You know what? I played it the day you told me about it, and then the next day, and I haven't gone back. But now that you reminded me, I definitely want to go back.
Yeah, for folks who are, it's like sports Wordle is the best way I can describe it.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I just felt like
it's very unforgiving, I feel.
Super unforgiving. I got to be honest, I don't always, I sort of do it with my buddy when he comes over to watch like sports. Okay. We sort of do it in the background, and sort of doing it as a group is a fun way of doing it. Sort of like a pull in the room, right? Because it's hard otherwise. It's not easy to do any of them.
Especially
And I try and get out on over my skis and try and do the soccer one sometimes. And that's always a disaster. I'm like, I know a little bit about soccer. It's like, no, you don't. No, you think you do, but you don't.
I looked at one of those grids and I'm like, oh, wow. There's no way. I mean,
what is baseball your wheelhouse? I was trying to figure out. That's probably the one. That's the one you're in on.
Yeah, that's the one that I'm most competent at. But I still, you know. I haven't completed a grid.
I mean, we're mostly, I would say by the time, if you're doing it with a group, it's almost like cheating. So I got to give my buddy Justin for Maiden Utica credit. He pulls some stuff. You ever got a friend who's like really good at sports stats? Like you think this dude knows more players than I give him credit for. I don't know how he thinks about anything else. It's insane. Some of the people he's pulling. So if you're one of those kind of people, even with sports that we're bad at, like hockey and stuff, check out the Immaculate Grid. I'm not getting paid for them. I just think you folks will like it if you like this show.
Yeah.
All right, Randall, this was fun. Had a great time talking to you this week. We will be back next week with episode 2. I think it will be Monica Seles, unless we change our mind between now and then. But otherwise, Randall, thanks for everything today. It's been great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Welcome back, folks. Season 2.